have, like David, like Daniel, beg your pardon, have the opportunity to advance up the social, professional career ladder, to take position of influence and advantage, that you are any less in a world that is hostile to God. The world that we have has exactly the same disposition as Nebuchadnezzar, who would sack the temple of God and take its stuff and say, we've defeated you, we are the ones who are in charge. Yes, there may be an established church in this country. There may be bishops in the House of Lords. That's what it may appear to be, a Christian country, but it doesn't prevent the head of religious programming in the BBC being a Muslim, because that's where the real values lie. It's not what it looks like. It's what it really is. The sympathies are all against Christians and against God. And like Daniel then, we must be alert to the fact that we are in a hostile environment, but we must also be absolutely certain that the Lord is God. That He is the one who gives. He is the one who rules. He is the one who dictates a hostile environment. Well, let's move on then to our second point, verses 3 to 7, which I've entitled A Subtle Approach. And here, of course, I'm describing the approach that Nebuchadnezzar, that Babylon took in seeking to influence. From the standpoint of essential hostility to God and to His people and to His ways, the approach that they took in dealing with Daniel and his friends. Now, we've seen it, of course, again in Esther, but I just noted again that throughout history, Babylon, the great enemy of God and of God's people, will take one of two approaches, either seduction or persecution. Either a big smile or steel teeth. Come and join us, or if you won't join us, then we'll flatten you. Esther, of course, starts out with the seduction. Life is so good in Persia. The people of God, the Jews, have had opportunity to go back, but they don't go back. Esther and Mordecai's generation settles very happily because initially it is a good place to be. It very quickly turns to persecution when Haman then manipulates things so that genocide is threatened against the people. And here in Daniel, we have in the first chapter, it is the smiling face of Babylon that would seek to draw Daniel and assimilate him into the whole pattern and manner of thinking of that godless culture. Later, of course, it's all hostility and it's all the lion's den and the fiery furnace when it bears its fangs, where its sharp steel teeth are no longer concealed by the apparently benign smile. And so we're in the seduction, assimilation phase. How does it work? Well, it's so vividly revealed, of course, is it not, in this chapter. How does Babylon go about seeking to win people over to its side? I've suggested four things. The first is the danger of isolation. Verse 3 says, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, to bring them in from Jerusalem into Babylon, to take them away from home, away from the temple, away from the priesthood, away from the sacrificial system, away from the practicing of the law of God and the worship of God, for there to be distance, separation, isolation. 14 odd years old, separated from his family, all of those old influences and rituals of his Old Testament faith, isolation, potentially utterly devastating to any kind of spiritual vitality. There are pressures on us to become isolated from God and his people and his worship and his ways, to drift. To be less enthusiastic about church than we ought to be. And isolation always brings about a devastating loss of spiritual vitality. It's a hackneyed illustration only because it is so apt. the red-hot coal which falls out of the fire and by separation and isolation cools down and is extinguished. And then there is the drip-drip of indoctrination. Verses 4 and 5 describe for us that these young, handsome men who had a native ability for learning and a quickness to understand were to be taught the language and literature of the Babylonians and to be assigned food from the king's table. This is what we're going to be taught, Babylonian literature and the language, and we're told just a little later on that they were signing up for a 3-year degree course. It's very similar to a bachelor's degree in this country. 3 years of constant exposure to a certain way of thinking is deemed sufficient to turn your mind in that direction. That's what university education is all about. Some degrees, of course, are longer, but that's the way that it works. If you have been exposed constantly to a way of thinking for a certain amount of time, then that becomes your way of thinking. That becomes natural to you. What seemed strange initially becomes entirely familiar to you. When we went to Ethiopia, people, I planned to just write up my observations because I wanted a record of things which I thought would be exotic and different. And people said, write down your impressions straight away. Because after a few weeks, after a few months, what's going to happen is that the stuff that you noticed, you won't notice anymore. What was so stark and exotic and strange will just become everyday and you'll barely notice it. Now, I'm not sure how many people this will be directly relevant to, but a university degree in Britain can quite literally replicate this process of taking somebody with a Christian perspective on things and after 3 years turning their minds right away from it. And in my experience, from people who've studied English literature, that vivid, influential, impressive embodiment of the thinking and the values of the culture, how many professing Christians have gone into university, have for 3 years studied English literature, and have been virtually ruined by it, as they've allowed their minds to imbibe the values that have been so articulately conveyed in the literature of the culture. And so that can quite literally happen in a university degree over 3 years, but the application is surely wider. If you allow yourself unthinkingly to be exposed to the values and the thinking of the Babylon in which we live, then you will adopt its way of thinking, its reasoning, and its values. The danger of isolation, the drip-drip of indoctrination, is certainly the appeal of ease. Now here I'm referring to the first part of verse 5, where there's reference made to the fact that the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. Why did Daniel resist eating the food from the king's table? Now you may think that that's an easy question to answer, but it's not actually so easy. So the first thought that comes to mind was, because if he ate it, why did he think he was going to defile himself? Because it was contrary to the Mosaic dietary laws from the Old Testament. Except that he refused to take the wine from the king's table, and the Old Testament dietary laws didn't object to drinking wine. So that wasn't the reason. Because the food had been offered to the pagan gods, and therefore food being offered to idols, if they ate it, they were... Daniel saw that he would become implicated in idolatry. But if the meat and the wine had been offered, why not also the vegetables? So what's the difference there? So perhaps it wasn't idolatry after all. And I'm not certain, but it just may be that the clue lies just in the information that we're given. The contrast between verse 5 and verse 12. Verse 5, the king's choice food. Verse 12, vegetables and water. The king's choice food, vegetables and water. Wasn't the one perhaps just an introduction to to the deadly appeal of ease. But Daniel was very, very afraid that if he started to get into the lifestyle of the Babylonian court, its privileges, its luxuries, its food, its feasts, its clothing, that he would stop seeing himself as an exiled Israelite separated from the worship of God and from the temple, and would start to feel, well, I quite fancy myself, a dandy in courtier's clothing and eating food from the king's table. And it may just be that Daniel saw that it was the appeal of ease that would lead him to settle down too readily and adopt the values of that culture and lose the sharpness of his distinctive as a man of God. I found this the most challenging of all, coming back to Daniel chapter 1. Every luxury I allow myself makes going back a little bit more difficult. I'm scared of getting a smarter car than the one that I've got, because I'll never want an old banger again. Doesn't it just... That becomes normal for me. That becomes what I am. What I'm familiar with becomes what I think that I'm worth. And so I don't judge you, but I must judge my own heart as to how much care I take to be sure that I live in such a way that doesn't make me too comfortable in Babylon. And then the confusion of identity. Verses 6 and 7. This is all about the name change. Names, of course, have everything to do with identity. I bet you that if I said, Clayton, only one person has smiled. Only one person will respond. Why? Because your name is you. It's your identity. There's no other Clayton here. Even more so with Hebrew names, which summed up more than their identity of the person, but what they were and what they stood for. And each of these four boys, Daniel and his three friends, had names that incorporated, as you doubtless know, the Hebrew words for God. Daniel, Daniel, El, one of the common Old Testament Hebrew words for God. And then the others, who in our English translation end in I-A-H, Hananiah, that the end of that of those names are incorporating Yah, short for Yahweh, Jehovah, the Lord God. And so that's what their names meant. They were Hebrew. They were Hebrews. They worshipped El, Yahweh. They were God's people. That was their identity. And so they're given new names. And these are Babylonian names. And the Babylonian names incorporate the names of the pagan gods. Gods such as Bel, Belteshazzar, and Nebo, Abednego. And so if you are Azariah, what happens in one fell swoop, whenever you hear your name called, and whenever you start thinking about yourself, it's no longer Azariah, Jehovah has helped, but it is Abednego, servant of Nebo. I have a new identity. Now, the application to us is clear, is it not? That when you're converted, your identity changes. Once upon a time, you were just a citizen of this world. In Jesus' terms, child of the devil. And when you're converted, your identity changes radically. Whatever your given name, your Christian name, given to you by your parents, you now become Christian. That's your new name. You're Christ's one. That's your whole identity. You belong to Christ. That's who you are. And the whole project of the world and of its constant influence is to get you to revert back to your old identity, to suck you back, just to become indistinguishable from everyone else and just like what you used to be. It's a subtle approach. How very, very difficult to resist. And we will see as we progress through Daniel just how it was that Daniel, with all of the odds stacked against him, remained faithful. Stu Dolliott, with delightful simplicity, says, how did Daniel remain faithful? By Bible reading and prayer. We will encounter that. He read the scriptures. Chapter 9 and verse 2, the prophet Jeremiah. He had access to them, and he read them, and that's what kept his mind and his thinking true. And he prayed. And we will find how frequently he prays throughout the book of Daniel. He prayed when he needed help in interpreting the king's dream. He prayed when he was threatened with death for doing so. He prayed a magnificent prayer in chapter 9. He read his Bible and he prayed. And Stuart Ollier's point is just so clear that we think we will be better Christians and more faithful if only our circumstances would improve and not be as bad and as difficult as they are. And he says, stand back and see Daniel. In the worst of situations, as hostile as can be from both the subtlety angle and from the hostility angle, and yet he, in the Bible, which is not afraid to tell us about the warts and the faults of its heroes, stands out as one of the people in Scripture who is utterly blameless. The great inspiration and example for us too. Well, we move on to verses 8 to 16, number 3, a firm resolve. We've seen a hostile environment, a subtle approach, and now a firm resolve, verses 8 to 16. So Daniel then is, despite the subtlety, despite the temptation, despite the appeals to have a complete identity change and to become Babylonian, to think like a Babylonian, he responds blamelessly and faithfully. What are the features of his godly response? Well, just another, briefly, four perspectives. The first is that he had spiritual perception, verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Others looked and said, ah, delicious food. We're going to do well in Babylon. And Daniel looked and said, ah, a snare. If I go along with this, it will trap my soul. I will not do it. And undoubtedly then, different young men from Judah looked at the same set of circumstances and responded entirely differently. It required spiritual deception to see that good food and wine would defile. We have to be utterly alert to look at circumstances, thoughts, opportunities, and to see when they are actually temptations. That's where firm resolve begins. Spiritual perception. And it moves on to firm resolve. And again, verse 8, but Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Or in one of the other translations, Daniel made up his mind. That's, when you stop and think about it, that is so apt a description. Babylon was doing its level best to dictate to Daniel how to think. But Daniel made up his own mind. Daniel thought independently. Daniel had his mind governed, if Stuart Ollier is right, by reading the scriptures and prayer. His mind would not succumb to the thinking and the values and the reasoning of his own culture, but it would be governed by God and his word. And so he made up his own mind, and he did so by way of resolve. Now, there are circumstances, surely, where it's necessary for us to be quite clear that we will not drift with the flow, but rather that we will be, like Daniel, decisive. When action is needed to be taken, to go against the flow, in order to remain faithful to the Lord, that we will take a firm resolve and decisive action to do so. Spiritual perception, firm resolve, and he pursued that resolve with verses 8 to 12, what I think may helpfully be called modest wisdom. As one of the commentators points out, Daniel is the quintessential wise man of the Old Testament. What is wisdom? The way the commentator put it, it's navigating life. It's doing the right thing in the right way at the right time. And Daniel, in the way that he approaches this whole matter of having privately made his resolve and then living it out, is absolutely exemplary in modest, godly wisdom. Mordecai was unwise, wasn't he? I think Mordecai was unwise. He chose the wrong battle to fight, and he did it in the wrong way, publicly. I won't bow down to you, Haman. And it actually brought consequences on himself and on the whole Jewish nation. Daniel is wiser. He's more measured. He's more modest. When he takes a stand as a Christian in the workplace, he's not awkward or obnoxious. He actually keeps, first of all, his resolve to himself. And then when he goes, in order to try and get a change of dietary regime, he doesn't issue an ultimatum. He doesn't up front say to the chief official, well, I've decided this is what I'm going to do, and if you don't like it, what's going to happen is that I'm going to, whether I die or not, do it anyway. There's no bombast. There's no pride. He doesn't embarrass anyone else. He understands that it's going to actually, given the circumstances, be rather awkward for the bloke to comply. Because if it doesn't work out, he's going to lose his head. So he comes up with a suggestion, well, let's give it a trial. And if it works, then we'll carry on with it. And if it doesn't, well, there's no histrionics. He finds a way that makes it easy for his opponent, effectively, to agree. And he finds favour with his opponent. I reflected on that, and I wondered whether sometimes what happens is that what's happened is that when we come to be resolved about something, we've actually had quite a huge battle within ourselves. We've had to treat ourselves rather firmly and roughly and emphatically. And then we kind of translate that action to other people, expecting that they are going to be resistant to the idea as we were ourselves, that we must treat them the same way that we treat ourselves. And we just shift that kind of emphatic, blunt firmness to others, with which we've had to deal with our own reluctance. No, Daniel stands out as the quintessential wise man of the Old Testament who navigates life according to the values of God, the right thing, in the right way, in the right place, measured, not awkward, not obnoxious. I probably needed to know that when I was a new Christian at school. You might have needed to know that as a Christian too. You may need to know it now to realize that the only way of standing for God before others is not necessarily the way that will obviously offend. And then it moves on to expectant trust, where in verse 13, Daniel, though he's not certain of the outcome, he leaves it confidently in the hands of God. A hostile environment, like the one we live in, a subtle approach to which we also are exposed in our Babylon, a firm resolve very often demanded of us with spiritual perception, modest wisdom, and leaving the outcome to God. And then verses 17 to 21 take us on to what is for Daniel a favorable outcome. It's quite remarkable, really. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them. It was an oral exam, not a written exam. And he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom, and Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. He was successful, and he was established. He was in the service of the king of Babylon from then until the first year of King Cyrus, 70 years. That's what God did for him. He was there was a favorable outcome in Daniel's case. When we stand for God, is there always that kind of favorable outcome? I was reading Sinclair Ferguson on this, and on Daniel, and he said how, as a young boy, he was drawn to Daniel and he enjoyed it. And I must confess that I've often come to Daniel and thought, Daniel is nothing like me. He's good looking. He's without any physical defect. He has aptitude for every kind of learning, quick to understand. He is one of the nobility it is nothing like me. And then when he sat his oral examination, he was 10 times better than all the rest. I wasn't. I was average. It's one of the great risks, isn't it? We're very zealous Christian students go to university and forget their relative ignorance and subordination to the lecturers and beat on about the Christian testimony about things as though they've got as much knowledge of their field as their professor or the lecturer, and they haven't. And it would befit them to be much more humble, even though they think they're being bold and in their testimony for God. No, the interesting thing about reading biblical history is that you can't always draw parallels between the circumstances and the events and the heroes and the characters and ourselves. There are differences. I'm not a Daniel. I'm not as clever as Daniel, or good-looking, or wise. And the interesting thing is that as you progress through the book of Daniel, you find that that things weren't always the same even with Daniel, were they? Here, there was all success. Later on, Daniel is not preserved in that same way. He finds himself in the fiery furnace and in the lion's den and has to be rescued from that. And of course, in the end, Daniel dies. And so we are called, like Daniel, in hostile circumstances, to be alert to the spiritual issues, to be resolved, and to commit the outcome to God, and as Daniel himself acknowledged later in the book, whatever it may be, we will be faithful to God, whether he preserves and spares us or not. And there are many instances down through our church history where God doesn't preserve his people from death. Every single martyrdom bears testimony to that fact. But the fact that they go to martyrdom, faithfully believing in the Lord, is in itself testimony to the fact that God preserves his faithful people in the way that they best need preserving, keeps them faithful in their faith to the end. I think it's only very prominent Christian leaders who share all of these things with Daniel. When I was doing church history, it suddenly dawned on me, I'm John Huss, early reformer, Martin Luther, John Calvin, Lloyd Jones. They were all brilliant. They were intellectually brilliant. Calvin was already teaching his teachers before he graduated and was trusted by his teachers to teach his contemporary students because he was a genius. Lloyd Jones, it's been said of people who knew him that if he, in whatever field he took, he would have been a leader. He was ahead of others in the medical field. He was a Christian leader. They said if he'd gone into politics, he would have been prime minister of this country. And that presumably is the case, that if God wants to put a person in a position of prominent influence, he equips them with what they need. Daniel was such a man, and so he was enabled to be 10 times more successful in his end of degree oral exam than all the others. But it's not necessarily going to happen to you. You may struggle on with it and achieve a 2-2 or even a third class degree. But God will protect and produce the outcome that he desires for every one of his people who remains faithful to him. And Daniel is for us, as all the commentators point out, a fine example of a man who started out in chapter 1 being faithful in small things, so that when the bigger challenges came, he became then faithful in bigger things. And the great stress, practical stress of the story then is this, that it may seem just all about food, such a small thing. In our own minds, we may see ourselves taking a stand for Jesus Christ as something heroic over a big issue, and then something piddling and minor goes on and comes our way, and we think, well, whether we compromise or not, and there's not many people are going to notice. The great lesson of Daniel is for every challenge of faith that comes our way, however small and minor it may seem, if God, by his grace, has given us the spiritual perception to see that there are spiritual issues at stake. Don't compromise. Be resolved in your own mind. See what the issues are. Take your stand and be faithful to him. And he who is faithful in little will be faithful in much. And so Daniel was entrusted with such a significant role in the future events that unfolded in the book. Godliness in a hostile world. God help us as his people to that extent to be like Daniel.